pauses. All right, it's going. It's going. Dr. Wayrock, how's it going?
Going very well, my friend. Good to see you.
Wait, say that again?
Can you hear
there
me?
There it is. Good. I had it. How you doing?
Doing very well, my friend. It is great to connect with you. I feel like I'm hanging out with a friend, not talking with a fellow professional.
Same. That's I love that. You know, that's kind of what I go for here. I like to be just a chat, easy conversation, easy listening for listeners. It's not like going through a textbook chapter.
Right. Yeah. Hopefully no more of that. Congratulations. Speaking of,
thank you.
End of a massive journey. That's incredible.
And likewise, you've been blowing up all over Instagram.
You know, I think it all changed after you tagged me and invited me on.
No way.
From last time. No, it's pretty funny to reflect on, like, even before, you know, like when I met with you, I used my laptop, I was in my home office, and now I have a little stand for my iPhone. I have scrubs provided by an awesome company that is just very kindly provided them that I'd be happy to talk about. We got a little Rode microphone speaker. It's funny how you can just kind of cultivate a little bit more of a skill set only just kind of by just necessity. Yeah. You know,
yeah.
Just the fact that you keep creating content, for lack of a better word, and it's been a lot of fun.
And you're creating good content too. You're not just like, hey, look at my butt, how this looks in these, you know, scrubs over here. No, it's, you know what I mean? Like you're giving, like the LPAs, I was just listening to your video on that. I commented on the video posted today. I mean,
yeah.
Stuff, excellent stuff. This is what we got to be talking about.
Well, I really appreciate that because I thought it would be fun to reflect on kind of the journey of posting as a clinician, for me, you know, as a physician, for you as a surgeon. And it's really interesting because when I committed to posting and I was told by my division chief, the least likely person in the world that could recommend to start a social media account, when I finally committed to post frequently, it was more commit to the process, not the outcome.
Yeah.
You know, I can't control if someone follows me or likes a post or comments, but I can just do my best and post consistently. So I thought, okay, I'm going to post a reel a day on average for a year. And my goal was to have 1,000 followers by the end of the year, which would be like Labor Day a couple months from now. And it's grown significantly faster than that, which I did not anticipate. And so even with that, I thought after 2 years, I might have 10,000 followers and then I would start posting on other platforms. And then with encouragement from the people that I've collaborated with on here and like my brother now posting on TikTok and now posting over to YouTube, and I'll start doing long format videos on YouTube. So it's definitely taken on a life of its own. But thank you for the compliment.
It's blowing up. So you thought 1,000 followers in a year, which would be about Labor Day, and here you are at 29,000-30,000 followers on Instagram. Look, I'm going to say it. You were off.
Well, I appreciate that, but even this is how adorable this is. I didn't know what a link tree was. For those that don't know, it's a link that you can put in your profile so that people can link out to any of your partner resources or companies or whatever it is. So just to have a link in my profile when I first started, I thought I recommend air fryers to everyone. So I put a link in my profile to air fryers that just went straight to Amazon when I started out. And now there's a link tree. It's a little bit, hopefully it's endearingly lame, not just lame, that I actually asked ChatGPT in May. I had 3.8 million views on Instagram, and I just didn't know if that was a lot. And so I asked ChatGPT, is that a lot of views? And ChatGPT was like, that's a weird amount of views for how small your channel is.
It said that?
That was the subtext. It was very complimentary. It was a very nice language model AI saying like, oh, that's a lot of views. And I've been really honored that people have engaged with the content. And it's exactly like what you've said. I don't think it was that people wanted to be entertained so much as learn something.
Yep.
And I've been really encouraged by it. So now even with just having posted that short series about lipoprotein little A, just as I keep track of what people engage with, a lot of it, it's really cool. It's been engagement with talking through lipoproteins, talking through cholesterol, LDL versus HDL and triglyceride, does it matter? Mm. It's been really cool to see people reacting to the educational content that I thought that I would have to try to capture attention to get attention to, because that was always my primary goal, was just to share heart attack prevention.
And you're doing it. You're doing it and you're killing it. So many people are finding such benefits and advantages to listening to your content, learning from it. And I am as well. I am as well. That is so fun. I didn't realize that the air fryer you would put in your bio first before you found the link tree. Really? Yeah. You just threw that?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's like, hey, these instant, you know, which you and I have talked about this, right? Kind of being friends offline from this session. You know, it was really cool when I was running in a sprint triathlon. So this has happened since we met. So I did a post that was kind of teasing the fact that if you marketed flu vaccines in a tactical way, you could probably entice a lot of guys to get their flu shot that they might otherwise pass on. So I tried to take a humor approach to evangelizing getting your flu shot. And I was really excited that that got a number of views. And so then I'm running in kind of this rural town sprint triathlon. Like there's not a lot of people. And I'm wearing like, it's cold out. I'm wearing a beanie. I have sunglasses on and it's cold in the winter. They were holding the sprint triathlon, but the swim was in a pool and it was so cold. They did run, bike, swim instead of the normal swim, bike, run. So I'm for a physician, I do my best. I'm pretty obsessed with triathlon. I'm trying to be pretty fast. And so I take off running. I'm running like as hard as I can for this 5K opening run leg. And I'm like a mile in. I'm in about 10th place in the field. And then this guy goes to pass me. And he, instead of passing, because he's like running faster, so he could have kept running by me. He slows passing me to run alongside me. And he says, I saw your vaccine reel. I was like, what?
Literally in the middle of triathlon right now, people are stopping you.
Yeah. Like as we're running at like 6 minute pace. I think it was 5:50 pace. So I was running like about as hard as I sustainably could. And he pulls up alongside and says, it's like, hey man, saw your vaccine reel. And it was really cool because I told him like, I really like while we're running, like barely talking, I said, I really appreciate the support. I'm just a random physician making videos.
Not random anymore.
So like not an influencer, not a content creator, not pushing for anything more than just trying to share education that it seems like it's hard to get from just FaceTime with like overworked clinicians. Right.
Educator, mentor. Absolutely. Absolutely. That's what it's all about. That's what it's all about. And I think, and you know, it's going to be interesting to see where we go with this. You know, we talked about that as far as, you know, kind of spreading those, the advice, the insight, the knowledge in different forms of, I was thinking about maybe creating like a black cloud shirt so that all the black clouds out there, we could all like get it.
Yeah.
But like, not to necessarily make money, but to remember like, the Black Cloud Knights suck. They are the worst part of residency, right? One of the top three worst parts. You know, when you're in a Black Cloud Knight and you're a Black Cloud, you're, oh my God, you know, you might be having 15 consults overnight and you're like, how am I going to get out of this hole? I'm going to be seeing consults to noon tomorrow. And, you know, I really think that it's not motivating. You know, that's like the lowest of the low. And I think that you just got to have to take a step back and remember that other people have been there for, and you're going to get through it. You got to take it one consult at a time. I don't know. It's just a thought, just a side note, but no, back to that. That's a wait. You were saying 5:56 minute pace for the 5K part?
In the sprint triathlon. So it's a sprint distance, 5K, and so then shooting for like trying to run about as fast as you sustainably can for like
fast
distance. Oh, thank you. It's kind of funny. I'm a bigger guy, so I'm like 6'2", 200 pounds, working on getting lighter. And I'll tell my wife that it's really kind of fun when I show up at these half marathons and I tell my patients this. It's really just about do your best. Don't compare yourself to anyone else, but like you can be surprised how you can perform just like training consistently.
That's right.
So you were really kind in meeting with me earlier just because I finally switched for the first time ever to training in the morning. Now going to bed at night, protect your sleep, you know, get 7 hours. That's my goal. But I've tried to share that message too, because I have had so many messages. It's been incredible every time when a pre-med or a med student messages me and they say, thank you for your channel. I keep seeing all these physicians and they say, don't become a doctor. Don't go into medicine. Don't do it. Burn out. Do something else. And then when they see a comment or they see a reel from me, it's like, hey, everyone's different, right? So I don't know if it would be true for you, but my marriage is the best it's ever been. I dropped both my children off at school and daycare this morning. I made my son lunch. I'm home every night, you know, for dinner. I am passionately pursuing all of my hobbies. We're traveling internationally. I have job security. I have this incredible vocation where I love the work that I do. It's all positive. And so that's nice because I'm also honest about how and you know this better than I do, how rigorous the training is. So just if I could have gone back in time and known how happy I would have been on the other side, I would have been really encouraged. And if I could have known that there are really happy physicians, right? Yep. That I would have been encouraged by that too. So that's been a really nice side part of this, the reach that you can have through social media. It's just been completely, just about all completely positive.
That's, that's so important though. Cause I'm still in the middle of finding out if, cause I get it asked all the time, you know, you're a dentist, you're a surgeon, you're a doctor. Same question is like, is it worth it? You know, you get that. I think every TikTok live I do, which is once a week, just about that question comes up every time. And I'm like, To be fair, I don't know yet. You know, I just graduated residency. I'm not working. I'm not in the real world.
Interesting.
How can I possibly answer that without a biased opinion, without the full picture? Because I don't have that full picture yet necessarily. And you're in that now. I guess my question would be, where was that kind of switch? Because obviously in your specialty training, the fellowship and everything, that might not have been the best time to ask that question to you either, right? When was that kind of switch? Yeah. You said it's afterwards as an attending and such, but like, when it, in the beginning, was it still like that? Like right away, it was the best, but did you have to do something to get to that point? I think what I'm getting to is like, first you need to ask yourself and gain that self-awareness and say, what is that perfect work week for me? So that I get the balance of all my side hobbies, training for a marathon, for triathlons, getting that time with family, making sure you could drop off your kids in the morning and getting that time, but also say, setting out that time for the right work week. Is it working overnight? Is it working just during the day? Is it a 9 to 5? You know what it, so you know what I'm saying? Like, I know that's a long-winded kind of question, but how did you kind of get into that comfort zone, that sweet spot of your optimal day to day? You know?
Yeah. No, I've really reflected on that a lot. It's been pretty surprising. And if I kind of described my training and then when I had that revelation, so you do 4 years of pre-med and then you do 4 years of medical school. I did 3 years of residency and then 3 years of fellowship. And in residency, I was at the Mayo Clinic. So I did med school in Seattle, University of Washington, go Huskies. And then at residency Mayo Clinic, it was a fantastic program. It was still rigorous. You know, it's called residency, right? As you know, like you're residing in the hospital. So still rigorous. But then where I went to fellowship, the approach with pediatric cardiology is you work in concert with CT surgery. And so it's very much a cardiac ICU and inpatient focused fellowship program with very few pediatric cardiology fellows. So then you had high acuity, complex patients with little staff to cover it. So that meant that in fellowship, for my first year of fellowship, for example, I was Q4 for 36-hour call, sometimes 24-hour calls, just for the straight year, Q3, like Q4? No reprieve.
So yeah. Just listeners, just what that means, Q3 is like every third day, Q4 is every fourth day. So Q3, every third day you're on, and you said 20, how long?
If you got lucky, you got the Friday shift into Saturday morning, which was 24 hours, and then you'd go home, but then you would do Sunday through into Monday evening. So then you would kind of on the flip side,
36 hours Monday evening?
Yeah. Over the weekend. And it was not compatible with quality mental health. So the reason that I always try to put it into the context of how happy I am now, like really in so many ways, living like my best life or exactly how I could or would have wanted to envision what my actual life would be. But there were two points during that first year of fellowship where I had a fantasy that I would get a terminal illness so that it would be over without quitting. And that's a really dark thing to mention. And I don't think I mentioned that to my wife for the longest time, which it was never any active kind of self-harm type thing, but it was truly best described as that. And so part of what I want to do too with this platform is speaking into so many things, yep. Right? And there's different ways that we could better approach training for med students, residents, fellows that I think could better protect them. So
absolutely.
I would have loved to have known then how happy I would be now to know that there's this light at the end of the tunnel. Yeah. But really, it took me a solid 3 years of a good lifestyle as an attending to kind of feel like mentally balanced.
3 years.
And have a positive. Yeah. So I would say probably a 3 year kind of recovery period.
It's a long time. That's a long time. That first year out, was it worse than it is now, or year 3, 4? Or was it just, it was the same, was year one the same as year three, or did it, you slowly kind of mold that into?
It got a little bit better. So then as a second year and then as a third year, you did less call. But I think the hard part was you're kind of just so chronically fatigued and sleep deprived that even the other frustrating thing that I ran into was even despite having that really rigorous schedule, you would have your senior faculty say, oh, back in the day, we were Q2, 24-hour call. We never left the hospital. And granted, I think that if you agree, medicine and surgery only gets more complex, right? Yeah. They weren't doing ECMO cases and having 3D echo and MRIs and complex caths and not doing nearly the complexity of the CT surgery mm-hmm. work that was being managed with these complex congenital heart patients having staged surgical palliations that we're working with. So it was much more complex. It was much more intense. And so I try to be guarded about that too, because even when in my third year, I got to do a night float system, that was still hard because saying that you worked a 36-hour shift gets your attention. But if you do like five nighttime 12-hour shifts in a row, you'll work like, it's actually 14 or whatever hours. You work 5 p.m. until 7 a.m. But then you're still working 7 to 8, wrapping stuff up. So then you drive home at 8:30, and now you try to sleep, but it's bright out, and you can't really. So you wake up at 12:30, and you feel kind of gross, but you can't fall asleep again. And you have to go into the hospital at night. Then you're working busy at night, but you're tired because it's nighttime, and you only got 4 hours of sleep. So even that only 12 hours, man, gosh, it's just still so brutal. Yeah, too.
And your body's just trying to say like, no, it's sunlight out. Let's get the most of the day. You got another triathlon coming up. You got to run. You got to, even just for mental health, regardless of training for something, you're just like, I got to go for a walk. But your body's saying, I got to go for a walk. I need mental health. I need this. And then you're hearing it from the other side. It's like, you need to get some sleep. You were just up and working actively all night, handling emergencies, running to the hospital, between the hospital here and there. So that was your fellowship those 3 years. But then you were saying the first 3 years as an attending, it took about 3 years for everything to just kind of settle down.
Yeah, even just to recover, just to have my mental health feel balanced, to not feel any kind of residual anxiety or depressive symptoms, or almost kind of like a PTSD from just the amount of work that you do. And kind of the things that you see, to be honest. So even this was really cool. I like to spread this message as well. And I talk about this with my patients all the time, because doing preventive health, I'm supposed to be the cholesterol doctor, but then I'll talk about sleep and stress first. Mm. And I'll tell them that with my current position, so I got an email and it's an academic center. They want their faculty and employees to succeed. So they sent out an email like, hey, by the way, you have 6 online therapy sessions that are free. And so I saw that email and kind of like noted it, but didn't do anything. And then my wife, coincidentally, sometime around that time, she said, you should see a therapist. And she wasn't talking about anything active. She was talking about processing the trauma of all the things that went into completing like medical training, fellowship, residency, all that stuff. As a related anecdote, the first time I had the kind of tragic privilege of calling time of death was on an infant. And it was just me at 2 a.m. And I didn't tell my wife about that for 5 years after it happened. You know, I just came home the next day.
Talk about trauma. That's the worst. I don't think it gets any worse than that, to have to, oh my God. Okay, I'm sorry to cut you off. You're talking about trauma. That's the background of trauma.
Right, as like one example. So then I jokingly said, that's my therapist, because we were by my mountain bike that I never get to ride. And I said, that's my therapy. I think there's some truth to that, right? Because now I get to do these cool races and have these great experiences and kind of live my best life. So there's a lot more positive. But then I actually went and met with a therapist. And part of what helped encourage me was, one, I obviously trust and respect my wife's recommendation. But two, I was listening to a podcast from a Navy SEAL. And he's this cool guy who had come back from his tours and was kind of broken by it. And the people interviewing him asked, like, how'd you recover? And he said, I didn't. My family basically staged an intervention, forced me to see a therapist, and therapy saved my life. And so I thought that was really cool. If a Navy SEAL can say that therapy saved his life, that encouraged me to then work, because I work with a lot of teenage male patients. And if they can have their, like, you know, male doctor say, hey, I saw a therapist, I really benefited from it, even just a couple times, I think that helps encourage them too. But it was also kind of alarming seeing the therapist because she was great. I had this fantastic relationship with her. And she said something that it shouldn't surprise me because she's a professional, but she was so insightful. She said after like the end of like our second or third session, and you talk for like an hour, she said, Derek, and this was unprompted and like cuttingly accurate. She said, Derek, I think that you could tell me something that would sound exactly like what I want to hear, that would seem like you're being really honest and insightful and being totally open, actually be really struggling inside and fool me. And I'm a professional. Mm. And she was right. And I thought that was amazing in a bad way, because part of medical and surgical training is like, you don't show weakness. It doesn't matter if you're tired. It matters if the job isn't done yet. And you just keep working until you're done. So yeah, it took a solid 3 years, I would say, of like good attending lifestyle to be happy. So I try to mention that too. And that's why when people ask me if I want either of my two little boys who are younger, just elementary school and then preschool ish age, do you want them to go into medicine? I'll jokingly answer, I just want them to be happy. I don't care what kind of engineer they are. that's my joke. That could be mechanical, it could be civil, I don't care. But you know, I'd be proud and sad, right? Because you're really proud, like, man, if my son became an oral surgeon, oh my gosh, that'd be so cool. And think of what they could do, and they're applying their skill set, that's great. But then you think about like the stress and the sad things and all the sleep deprivation, all that goes into it. And so I'd be proud and sad, I think, if they went into it.
And too, I want to just write into two topics that you made me think of. One, going back, well, let's touch on this one really quick. Going back to how people come to you and ask, there's a lot of content of doctors saying, I would have done something else, this and that I want to touch on. And then the other thing is what we could get into right now. I just saw a video this morning, actually, and this is talking about like the ridiculous hours, the 24-hour call shifts that are actually 20 up to 27 if you're abiding by the rules. The overnight shifts that may trail into 36, sometimes even more. Apparently, the residency program and structure of the years, the hours, and whatnot was created by, I forget what the name was, like Holtman or Holtzman or something. That's probably way off, but they said that he used to go to work and wake up by taking cocaine way back in the day, 100 years ago. And he would go to sleep by taking morphine. And this is the guy that created our residency structure. Is this, do we think this is normal? Is that why are we still, we can update the system. This is outdated. This is based off of false data. We know all these things are bad. So just to touch on that, you know what I mean? And I'm sure you got a lot of comments on, you heard this too.
No, my understanding is that is completely accurate. That I don't think it was known at the time that he used cocaine to maintain the cycle that residency was based off of, but it was revealed after that, he was using cocaine to handle the schedule that we're expected to do. And I even remember, so I did my trauma rotation at Harborview, and it was orthotrauma. And so even with that, that was my hardest med school rotation, because that surprisingly was also a Q3, like 36-hour shift, which I actually had a really benevolent, really awesome general surgery rotation. I had a super cool neurosurgery rotation. I might have gone into neurosurgery like had I had that happen a year before. Loved it. My orthotrauma was trauma. Right?
Yeah.
So it's pretty rigorous. And we were doing trauma at Harborview, and then it was daytime operating at the VA. So mostly joints and sports. Mm. And then overnight in trauma, like all bets are off. And then you're in the OR with booked cases the next day. And so I was in Seattle, and I didn't even see my wife that whole week, that whole month, because I was so absent, right? Just that call schedule I was completely unavailable. So I was sleeping on a mattress on the floor of one of my best friend med school classmates' house. So I'm so close to them. I'll see him in Seattle in July. And so I was sleeping on a mattress on their floor. And one time I got home from a call shift, and it was like 4 p.m., right? So like you'd worked the full day and then the night and then that day. And then I got home like 4, whatever it was, and I needed to sleep. So I had a leftover remnant of an energy drink, and I used that to finish a Benadryl, like 2 Benadryl to like try to fall asleep at 4. I was like, this is so unhealthy to be using your leftover
energy drink.
Your energy drink can to be able to have liquid to swallow Benadryls to fall asleep at four. It's ridiculous.
It did work. I bet it worked, right? You knocked it out.
I fell asleep. Yeah, yeah. Caffeine. I didn't need the Benadryl.
Oh my God. Caffeine mixing it with Benadryl. Yeah, this is the reality of it. I hope people get to listen to this. Yeah. This is the reality of, but guess what? It is getting better. It is getting better. And now this goes back to the other side of the coin where things are getting better. There are laws in place and more residencies and programs are accepting and abiding by those rules each year. The GME programs do auditing on certain hours of certain the residencies, the specialties and stuff. But your post that you just put out on the insurance, because I talk about this, I will talk anyone's ear off that wants to go into this. I think the problem is the insurance companies. And you just highlighted everything that the politicians and the insurance companies have sided and they're basically endorsing each other. It's textbook conflict of interest.
Yeah.
Just giving money back and forth to each other to keep the laws and the regulations the way they are. It's holding down the money that goes back to patient care and the people, the providers doing the patient care. And it kind of funnels in between this triangle of the insurance companies, the politicians, and the hospitals, and then back into the insurance companies, to the politicians, in the circle, but never to the patients and the providers doing and receiving the work. And that's just, and it's never going to change. In fact, we looked, I just saw the stat. It came out about a month and a half ago by the, I think it was OMSNIC. They sent an email. It said Medicaid B insurance reimbursement has actually decreased 33% when adjusted for inflation since 2001. That's 25 years. Another 25 years is going to go by. It's going to be 66% down. This is not a sustainable cycle. Look, it's getting better and we're having more providers and people and specialists talk about this now. And my biggest thing is presenting a solution. The solution to it, I think, is creating a new insurance company that actually incentivizes financially preventative care again. We need to get the people preventative care to prevent them from going to the ED when they have a problem. Because that's what we're seeing now in the middle, in the depths of Manhattan and Seattle and Chicago. And so that's, we are talking about it more. And I'm confident, I don't know when, if it's going to be 50 years from now or 10 years from now. But I think if we could get all the right people to listen to these things and get the right things in place, we could get some motion into creating a new insurance company. I created the algorithm with ChatGPT 2 months ago. We're getting there.
Interesting.
We're getting there. I think we can do it. We base it by location. We base it by who needs the care, what the cost of the area is. I really think we can get there. And it's going to take a lot of rocks to be turned over and stones to be, you know, undone. But I think we could get there. It's starting by talking about it. And you just put out the perfect post on it today. So I wanted to say kudos to you.
I love it. That's fascinating. And I really commend you being so proactive because I try to evangelize just the perspective of being more politically active about healthcare. Because when you think about it, so much of our system, if it was basically ended and remade, could work so well. We could do so many things and we have access to high quality care. But the fact that people are held hostage by unaffordable to anyone healthcare prices, forcing them to require health insurance that then can deny their care absent any justification, leading them, even regardless of if it's covered, to still pay inflated copays and deductibles and having to navigate that on top of the fact that we have completely disincentivized preventive care, just like you said, leads to this phenomenon where when I was talking with my brother who works in AI and they were talking about the application of AI technology to healthcare, I said, the problem is you could use a lot of refined technologies, but hospital systems and health insurance companies and politicians are profiting off the inefficiency, right? Yep. The brokenness is like the profit mechanism. And I think the hard part, what at least perspective was from the political perspective, would be that you would basically need a complete politician-driven like remake of the system. You could make health insurance mandatory for everyone. But with subsidies for low income, you could allow for universal private insurance with subsidies so it's affordable, and you would keep that from being punitive from a financial perspective by mandating cost caps.
Okay.
It's like, hey, an x-ray is only $200 anywhere ever. You can't charge more. And price transparency. Like, hey, Dr. Gallagher, we're going to do a heart ultrasound. It'll be $200 after your copay. Do you want to proceed? Mm-hmm. Right? It's like universal, subsidized for low income, private health insurance the American electorate would support, even if there's really good evidence that a single payer healthcare system would have better outcomes. They would still support that, which is otherwise kind of called the Swiss model, and we could do it. But it would take politicians doing it, and politicians aren't going to do it if they have stock in these healthcare companies and get campaign contributions from hospital systems and health insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies mm-hmm. that are all profiting off of how outrageously broken the system is.
Right. Right. My one critique that I was looking into as far as like the x-rays, say an x-ray is $200 and capped at that. The one thing, and I'm sure that would work, but this is more of a critique in other situations where, for example, say that x-ray machine breaks down. Now all the payments that those x-rays kind of, added up over the months, years, whatever it is to fix that x-ray, it should be fine, right? What is an x-ray machine going to cost to fix in Malibu versus in the middle of a lower area? That charging would be different. So my thoughts were, and this would actually solve getting providers into low income, low underrepresented areas, if it's based on a cap of the area. So say a median income or mean income, how whatever the mathematician think that would be the correct way, but mean or median income per zip code, for example. And in more spaced areas, you could couple zip codes together, more populated areas. You could really hone into the zip code or even smaller if you need to. But essentially, you have a certain number, you have certain reimbursements based on that median income, right? And then it's going to track inflation as time goes. So everything's going up according to the normal.
Nice.
But
yeah.
the way this helps is the underrepresented areas is that it's going to cap at a certain point. You can only have a certain number of providers in each area where there's a high income, right? Because everyone's going to work in the high income area so that they can make the higher income. But if the insurance company is based off of that area, there's going to end up being a cap on how many providers can actually be in there, in addition to the lower income and underrepresented areas. So after a certain amount, if now you're getting 10 over that number, 20 over that number, these dentists or doctors, providers, et cetera, are now making less money than the dentists, doctors, providers in the underrepresented communities, because it's all based on that market.
Nice.
That will give that financial incentive to get providers into those areas. And now, it doesn't solve the x-ray machine and the cost to fix it and stuff. But look, I'm just trying to put that information out there because I think based on using an algorithm made by ChatGPT, we can get, this was a response to why don't we have dental therapists given licenses to do fillings and stuff. But I said, look at CRNAs in those areas of other places to get it, get anesthesia and GA in underrepresented areas. But now they're all in the middle of Manhattan. CRNAs are in Miami. They're in LA. And now, like, they created this whole thing and now it's just taking away jobs for anesthesiologists so that hospitals could pay less to get people to do the same work. That will happen with dental therapists. And my point is you need to financially incentivize these people to go into those areas and work, right? And so, I don't know.
That's a fan. See, what I love about that, though, is the problem, I think, is that now here you have a passionate young surgeon that is driven off improving the system. And in so many cases, we don't have clinicians in positions of leadership. It's like administrators that are based off more optimizing profit and minimizing cost, not necessarily a patient-driven, like patient-centered focus for mm-hmm. like many or most healthcare systems. And so I've been really lucky to work in what I've considered to be really benevolent, like patient-focused healthcare organizations. I feel that way about my current one. Mayo Clinic, I think, was like a great example, although, no organization's perfect. But I think that's the thing, is we need like physician and surgeon leaders just like that. Ones that are taking advantage of new technology and new approaches to solve solvable.
Right. And change for the better and go in the direction of, because it's not, nothing's going to be perfect at first. But look, if you're just lobbying and making rules and regulations to boost profits, to make your job easier, that's another reason for this. They're just trying to make their and offload their work. We're never going to go in the right direction. We need to put in some work. We need to create. We need to use our creativities as human beings to create solutions to these problems. We have AI now, adjunctive. That's another thing. I think insurance companies and hospitals, they're going to implement AI to hire less PAs, hire less nurses. And then it just puts more responsibility and oversight on the physicians, on the head nurses, the administrators. And I don't know if that's the answer either, but yeah. Hey, we're getting there. We're getting there. I'm ready to switch topics. So how's work been lately? What's been going on, by the way?
Yeah, ironically, I was going to say regarding work yesterday, I get to my office, right? I'm like getting set up. I'm ready to go. Okay, good. I finally have some protected time to catch up on both some research protocols and patient prior studies. And then I get a priority message from a like administrative staff person that the heart ultrasound I ordered on a patient was denied by their health insurance company. And I have to do a peer-to-peer to justify it. It's already been denied. So I have to like appeal, peer-to-peer it, or the family is going to be stuck paying for it out of pocket. And the heart ultrasound was after she had heart surgery. Her first heart ultrasound after she had heart surgery to check her heart after literal heart surgery. And the heart ultrasound was denied. And so that shouldn't be legal. That shouldn't be allowed. And so that's kind of funny in that was just one incidence of what's considered to be a term that was kind of new to me, actually, moral injury. And so I connected with a couple surgeons on Instagram. And part of what led me to notice their accounts was reels I saw where they'd retired from surgery. Oh, yeah. They stopped relatively young. And in both cases, it seemed to be a major contributing factor was the moral injury of wanting to or trying to help your patients and being prevented from doing
yeah, it's
like cumulative stress.
Exactly. It's insurance-centered care now.
To be able to do your job.
It's insurance-centered care now. It's not patient-centered care anymore. This moral injury is packing up, piling up. And then the financial side of it too, because doctors, surgeons making less and less leads to less and less quality of life. What are these healthcare systems too? I'm curious your insight on this, and I want to go into moral injury, but I'm noticing a lot more institutions rather than, like I'm seeing a lot of, they're just creating different rules to allow foreign physicians and doctors and specialists to come into the country and work. And that's great, but it's different training. It's different backgrounds, educational backgrounds and stuff. And that might lead to different moral compasses, which I have seen firsthand. I'm curious because now it's like, you know, it used to be right now in dentistry, for example, you have to repeat 2 years. If you're a foreign dentist, you have to come to the United States. You have to repeat two and a half years of a advanced standing dental school. And then you could apply to residencies if you get your citizenship and stuff. So you have to repeat that. It gives it a longer cycle, but then it actually, I think it levels the playing field for all providers in dentistry of the United States. They don't have that in medicine, right? You could just do your residency here and then start working. Is that correct? Because I know someone from Turkey who did medical school in Turkey and then came here. Is that, I don't know if you...
Yeah, I think my understanding was that you can apply into a residency program as a foreign medical graduate. Mm. So you wouldn't have to repeat the medical school component. Right. So you're like foreign MD or foreign MBBS, whatever MD-DO equivalent, yes, is considered adequate to apply for residency. And then if you're accepted, you're accepted as an IMG, and then you can complete residency and then be like a fully licensed like physician or whatnot in America. Right. So they can still accept foreign medical graduates. I'm not aware of the process for how like a fully trained, has worked for 10 years, like Pakistani or Indian ENT surgeon might be able to just translate practices into America. But I think there's a push given our shortage and the bottleneck, or at least the worsening physician shortage, kind of regardless of any training bottleneck, maybe just from population growth and retirement, where they might try to fast track a process for foreign physicians to come in. And even if outcomes were the same or better, I interestingly saw, not to to catch myself in any kind of surprise personal bias, I would have thought that American medical training is so exceptional that the foreign trained like physician or surgeon would not have the same or better outcomes. And I found one paper, which I don't have the specifics from, like just short-term memory, where the international graduate physicians had better outcomes than US trained ones.
Wow.
Like I was pleasantly surprised. So even if we could address the physician shortage that way, I think the problem is all these countries that we would be stealing their physicians and surgeons from also need them too.
Yeah.
So it would kind of push the problem onto already otherwise strained countries, and then we'd have that brain drain effect.
Yeah.
I think it would be nice to kind of fix our domestic supply problem instead of like siphoning away foreign talent, even if we would still benefit from the foreign talent.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Though my one concern is what I've seen firsthand is that, like, for example, my dental school, those foreign trained dentists that come here that don't want to repeat dental school necessarily, just in the dentistry sphere, they end up working at dental schools under the institution's license rather than going through dental school residency and then getting their own license and operating under their own personalized license. And this allows the institution, what they're doing is they're paying these foreign dentists less than an American trained. So it's, oh, I can't find anyone. You know what? Let's lobby. Let's create the rule. Let's make it easier for foreign dentists to come in here. And they'll just work at the institutions. They'll be very happy to be here in the United States rather than in, I know some from Brazil. I know some from Germany. I know some from Turkey. I know some from India and so on and so forth. But I'm just concerned because it's allowing these institutions to pay people less. And then the education is, I didn't count, but there was a good portion of foreign training, and it's great for the balance and variability, the insight to other, you know, training in other countries and the way they do things and education there. But it's also, I'm concerned with that backdoor, making it easier for them to just get away with paying doctors and dentists and providers less. And this just seems to be the trend in every direction we go. It's about paying people less that are doing the work. And I don't know. So
no, I totally agree with you there. I do not see any part of the conversation being, let's proactively build more medical schools and fund more and better residencies. Yep. No one's talking about that. They're only talking about different ways to kind of like augment scope or create new positions, right? So even one interesting topic of conversation came up. I was going to do a series on underrated healthcare professionals. So like people that you don't typically think of, like the heart sonographers that I work with, echocardiographers, echotechs are incredible. They're like these skilled diagnosticians that are playing this musical instrument to diagnose complex congenital heart disease. People have no idea how skilled they are. So that would be an example of one. And respiratory therapists would be an example of another. And so when you are an ICU fellow, like as I've basically been, or like I'm not an ICU fellow, but I play one in real life, it's like a resident, which I wasn't a fellow, but then the cardiology fellow is the CICU fellow. So you're the cardiac ICU fellow as a cardiology fellow rotating through. And our ICU fellows are so proficient with respiratory, like mechanical ventilator management, and it gets really complex with these multi-system sick patients, especially post-operative CT surgery patients. If you have this pro respiratory therapist, they are the best. So like I'm singing the praises of respiratory therapists. Now there's a push for respiratory therapists with a change from respiratory therapist to respiratory therapy like practitioner to basically take on like an NPPA critical care advanced practice role and be doing like lines and procedures and then potentially adjusting medicines, which seems like a potential solution to a shortage of clinicians that would be comfortable with ventilator management. Except meanwhile, we aren't addressing the fact that if someone wants to be an ICU physician, they have to do a full 3-year residency before doing like a 3-year fellowship with an included like 1-year research experience that they may or may not be interested in, but helps the research CV of the ICU attendings that use the fellow workforce as part of their research apparatus. Nor can we allow any kind of cross-pollination between an ICU physician that might want to do more outpatient practice or an outpatient physician like an internist that wants to become an ICU doc. You know, so like I think there's been a definite lack of physician and surgeon empowerment in the addressing the physician and surgeon shortage, which is really ironic. And instead, there's all these conversations about like different new things that we can make.
Band-aids.
Instead of, doing a better job doing what we need to do, which is kind of taking the existing workforce, paying them better, supporting them better, and removing the existing barriers that are causing them to retire or be like basically handicapped in performing their job.
Right, right. Everywhere we look, we're seeing these, exactly what you said. These are barriers. These are rules. These are regulations that were created for a certain, but they keep putting up stop signs. They never take them down. And that's, right?
Well said. Yeah. Only stop signs. They're all talking about different ways we could address the physician shortage. No one's talking about making more like medical centers and residences.
Yes.
But it was really cool too. So I was actually angry. I was physically like angry about this heart ultrasound denial.
Oh.
But then the next email down was our patient feedback. And it would be like self-congratulatory to say, but the reason I'm sharing it is because it speaks to how rewarding being a physician is, because it was like, he was a godsend. Best physician I've ever seen. Like, we had an amazing experience. And so that, when you ask, like, how was your work? It was kind of a nice little window into it because, okay, it's like, oh, I show up to clinic, I've got a full clinic, I have research projects to do, you know, all good things, but I'm stressed from this time compression and the amount of work I have to do. I have to face this completely BS heart ultrasound denial, and that wastes my time. But then I get this amazing patient feedback and then have this great experience in clinic, and I'm home to like play in the pool with my two little boys. So like life is really good, and I'm really, really rewarded. I'm just motivated to try to make the system mm-hmm. better, medical training better, current practice better. That if my children become physicians or surgeons, I want them to have a better experience and to be better supported right. in that. Like, let's leave it better than we found it. And it's not going in that direction. Right. I think most would agree.
Do you know which healthcare insurance provider that was that denied that? I'm curious because I heard something about how.
I don't think it was one of the big ones that have been in the news recently.
Okay, got it. Because it makes me think of, I just saw a statistic where, I don't know which insurance provider it was, but one of them was saying they deny everything in like certain areas. They deny everything first. And they find that they limit right? everything, like 33% just go out the window if they deny it right away. And is that really, what if I just denied one third of my patients that walk in? What if you denied one third of your, like what, a baby in your arm? You're going to deny one third of them? No, it's, who do we even go, I don't even know who we go to about these things. And it's like, that's willing to listen, and we got to change these laws.
Yeah, but even the problem is, I think people could, so my personal perspective, not knowing anything, people with more gray hair and life experience than me might believe otherwise, but I think the American electorate could collectively band together and say, this next congressional cycle and this next presidential cycle, we are voting single issue, nothing else matters, crossing parties, fix healthcare, don't change anything else. You're not making improvements anyway in economic policy or international policy. You could just not fix anything else, just fix healthcare. And then Americans would have $4,000 a year, at least more in their pocket every year with less stress. 70,000 Americans with good estimate models are expected to die every year from a lack of access to healthcare based off our current system that we'd be prevented if they had access, right? So think about someone that had like a misdiagnosis of diabetes that goes into DKA and dies. Or someone that had a heart attack that didn't get a lipid check along with an Lp(a) or calcium artery scan and dies. They had chest pain, but they couldn't get in to see their doctor for a week or ever and dies. 70,000 a year, which is more than the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
Year after year after year of unnecessary preventable deaths. And I don't know, to be honest, in the current American political climate, if a Republican stepped up and said they would do it, which would be a bit surprising given it would require regulating right. if a Democrat would vote for them. And I don't think if a Democrat stepped up and did it, and they even said it wouldn't be some Medicare for all that might be politically polarizing, but they said, hey, I'm going to fix healthcare, universal private health insurance, we're going to make the health insurance companies pay right. for it. I don't know if a Republican would vote for a Democrat that was going to do that. You know, so I think that's the problem is everyone would complain vociferously about their own individual healthcare and health insurance experience. Mm. None of them will proactively vote effectively enough to fix it. And so that's what I'm trying to kind of advocate for, is that we need these either corrupt or inept or both politicians to actually do something.
Gotta go.
And no one's calling for them to do it.
They gotta go. What we gotta get them some moral injury, right?
You need to be president, and then I'll be your vice president, and then we'll just fix the system, and then we'll retire. It's gonna make practice a little bit awkward after, you know, Secret Service. You're gonna be in practice and have your Secret Service team. I'm gonna be running a triathlon with my like Secret Service team if vice presidents still get that after. But yeah, we just gotta fix it and then retire, because you need a politician that doesn't want to be a politician, right? You need someone to just go in there, fix it. This is annoying. We're just gonna fix this one thing. Done. Good to go. Not some lifelong, okay, I'll do whatever's politically tenable.
Yeah.
Not upset the party donors kind of career politician.
Right. In and out. Fix the problem. You're there to fix the problem, and then out. Leave. Yeah. Hey, that's a really great idea. That would be, and then if you're only focusing on one issue, then you have a better chance at doing it rather than getting distracted by all these other things. Yeah.
If someone, so I'm up on stage, I'm debating JD Vance, and they're like, Derek, what's your policy on abortion? I'm like, it doesn't matter. We're just going to fix healthcare. What's your policy on gun control? My policy is whatever policy happens going into it, we're fixing healthcare. and then being done. Abortions again are tied to healthcare, so I would say that, right, we would,
of course,
like, provide healthcare.
Not that it doesn't matter, but that it's like, this is not what I'm here for. Yeah. This is not what I'm...
But we're not legislating. The only thing we're legislating is just access to healthcare, mm-hmm. and then people can do whatever they want outside of that. You know, like, oh, what do you think about foreign policy? My foreign policy is we should have a healthcare system.
Yep.
And
yep.
we would, like, just fix the healthcare system and then say, vote for them after. You can vote for the exact same people as soon as we're done. Just let us fix the healthcare system and then we'll be on our way.
That's right.
So that would be nice.
Yeah. Yeah. And so just to switch, because we're coming on almost up on an hour right now, I wanted to hear a little bit how you're doing. How's the week going? I know I just asked you before, and then you mentioned that the peer-to-peer call that you have now that came up yesterday. Can we just run through your Monday through Friday one more time? Are you working any weekend?
Yeah. 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 So I'm a pediatric cardiologist and a preventive cardiologist. So I have a mix of structural heart patients like complex congenital heart disease all the way through innocent murmurs, arrhythmias, chest pain from advanced arrhythmias to innocent palpitations, chest pain from like myocarditis to innocent chest pain. So I see outpatient pediatric cardiology and then preventive cardiology from complex lipid disorders through acquired like metabolic health, which is my code word for obesity. And then having our basically metabolic health program, so our obesity program, I'm one of the specialist physicians that works in that too. And it has been incredibly rewarding. So like, I love the work that I do. I just like so often I leave clinic and my thought is I love my job, I love my life. Like kind of walking out into the sunshine, like whatever it is. And then, so I have that clinic experience. I'll do 3 or 4 clinics a week and then spend time in the evening with my family. I flipped my cycle so that I'm training for triathlon in the morning. I did 10 hours of training last week and then I'm trying to get competitive enough. I should qualify for the Half Ironman World Championships this year and then the Ironman World Championships, which is kind of more of a lifelong goal by age like 40 to 41. Nice. So coming up close on that. And even just in May, like May, April, I got to drive down to North Carolina, do a half Ironman, drive home. The week after I did a 5K trail ultramarathon, where I live, it's like, I'm living my best
life.
It's
the dream.
And I'm going to fly. So next week I'm doing an 8-hour trail ultramarathon where it's a timed trail ultra. So just how far can you run within the timed 8 hours? And it's going to be like 90s and humid this weekend. So I'm not sure what the weather is going to be like next week. Then I'm doing a Olympic distance triathlon and a 50-mile trail ultra in July, a half Ironman and a sprint triathlon in August, Ironman Chattanooga in September. Everyone come race me. I'll be at Ironman Chattanooga. And then I'll gear up to try to run either a fast marathon or a 100-mile trail ultra next spring, depending on where my fitness up.
Nothing September like, to December, January?
So September, I'll do Ironman Chattanooga.
That's the chat. Okay.
And then October. It's actually really fun. I'll do a half marathon that I do each year. And then in November, to run a sub-3-hour marathon, you need to run a sub-125 half marathon. So my plan would be to target that for a November half marathon.
Yeah.
And then we'll see.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. So you got it all scheduled. So right now, the next one next week is just how far or how long you can run. Is it, it's not a certain amount of time.
Yeah. It's really interesting. So they kind of flipped the script on some ultra marathons. So my trail ultra, which is the shortest ultra, was 31 miles and they tend to be over mountains. So it's quite mountainous, like thousands of feet of elevation gain, not just like the distance on like oftentimes pretty technical trails. I think I stopped counting at 20 creek crossings in the first half hour of this trail. I feel like jumping or just running through like rocky creeks. I was like, man, like, so like wet feet and whatnot. This one is, it's a basically like a 5K trail loop and it's just how many times can you run it in 8 hours and like go. So it's mostly a race workout to prep for the 50 mile that I'm doing in July. Yeah. And that one's really fun. So I grew up in Washington State. And when I was 16, I thought, and I was wrong, that I could run a 50-mile ultra. And so I tried to do it, was obviously overwhelmed because I didn't know what I was doing. And I DNF'd. And now for the first time now, well over 20 years later, I'm going back to finish it.
Nice.
So we're going to travel back to July. That's kind of fun because the joke is that there's only 2 hills, but you go over 2 mountains. So the 2 climbs are mountains at you. run over. So I've been doing my best to train, to have good fitness, to have not only just to finish, but to have like a good experience there too. But the sidebar that I would say is, if you're like a pre-med or a med student, pre-dental, whatever it is, seeing this, and if you were like me, where you're really passionate about triathlon, but you don't want to be a physician where you can't do that, I mean, it's an incredible blessing. But if, as I hope and expect to, I qualify for the Half Ironman World Championships in August, I'm there in Nice in September next year. And so then I can fly and go race in Nice. Like, what a privilege that is, right? Like, that I could do that. So I really think there are incredible benefits to the work that we do that are, it's easy to get bogged down in the negatives and not realize like, oh man, like that's so cool that, right, that we can do these things.
How many in the positives. How many weeks or days off a year do you get and able to kind of plan these out so you could hit every one and then plan your training days out too, as well as, you know, your work days?
Yeah. So it's still a little bit tight. And my wife would say that I'm kind of, or like maybe Manny would say that I'm kind of an outlier case in the degree of my interest. Mm-hmm. So I get 5 weeks of PTO off each year, plus like holidays. So I think that's pretty nice, especially for America. So I get 5 weeks of PTO. But even this was really fun. Last year, I was jumping off a boat off Alcatraz into San Francisco Bay to swim to the mainland and do the Escape from Alcatraz triathlon.
That's awesome.
So yeah, so it's like 7 a.m. or 7:15, 7:30, whenever it was. I was jumping off by Alcatraz in San Francisco Bay. 24 hours later, I was driving to my like rural outpatient clinic.
No way.
Yeah. So I say that I do these things, but you have to kind of work pretty hard to make them happen still. So it's not that it's necessarily that easy to do, but I finished the race in 2.5 hours, which I was really excited with, packed up my stuff. My mom and dad were there. My dad was racing, crushed it. My mom was this awesome crew. So hugged my mom after, packed up my stuff, rode my bike back to the hotel, packed up my bike to fly home, took our rental car, drove back and brought my parents lunch at the race, said goodbye to them, drove to the airport, and then flew a red eye home. And then went from home into clinic, and then had the clinic day. And so like there you go. So you can still kind of do these cool things. But interestingly, to kind of end at least from the triathlon perspective with one anecdote, I did a race now 2 years ago called the Leadville 100 mountain bike race in Colorado. Okay. And it's a 105-mile mountain bike race. And for those that don't know, when I was in like Ironman shape at the time, I went to ride my mountain bike and I'd ridden it uphill for like 20 minutes and I was gassed. Like riding a mountain bike and riding a mountain bike uphill can be really hard to do. So this is a 105-mile mountain bike race, and you go basically up a small mountain, kind of a little mountain, and then you end at like a 12,200-ish foot like height. It starts at 10,000 feet. The whole race is basically all above 9,000 feet, but you're at high altitude the whole time, which makes you like 30%-ish less fit, 20% at least. Mm-hmm. And it has a really high DNF rate. There were experiences of like pros like crying or blacking out that some elite amateurs would literally be riding and stop their bike and like kind of pass out on the side of the road, then like wake up and then like keep going to finish. It's this ridiculous race. And my wife, who had known that I'd been an endurance athlete for 20 years, had known about how difficult it was, how hard it would be to train for it as a physician and father, mostly training from my basement. Yeah. And she said, like, you're not going to finish Leadville. Like, just, you're not, like, how could you? You're not going to finish Leadville. And I finished Leadville. I had this amazing experience. My mom was there. She was my crew. It was amazing. I said, like, we did it. When we got to the finish, I, like, comfortably finished, got my belt buckle. And I was horrified the next morning that after doing this like 105-mile mountain bike race, that's this like legendary bucket list thing, that you're like exhausted, like barely coherent, like at some points of it finishing. The next morning when I woke up, I realized this past 24 hours was easier than a call shift.
Yeah, I remember you telling me that. I'm like, yeah.
Right? Yeah. And so that's wild. So that's where, you know, it's like I don't think people realize just how challenging the work is that we do. And so now it's like a privilege and a fun hobby to do some of these triathlon things. So I'll be posting more about that too, just because, you know, you're basically posting your personality when you post on social media. So sharing some more about
I think
that.
It's so excellent. And, you know, it's great because, I mean, look at the great shape that you're in. That's number one, physically in excellent shape. But then mentally too, it clears out your mind. I'm going to go for a run after this. So I'm in the same, I'm not doing triathlons or marathons, but it's the same thing. You get to clear your head, the mental health. It's better than anything else in the world. I mean, obviously sleep, clean diet is also great, but you got to exercise. I want to ask you, what's you said in your basement, what do you have in your, do you have, how do you practice swimming? You have a pool, but do you go to a gym or something? And then in the basement, you have a treadmill.
Can I show you?
Yeah, whatever, however you can. Yeah.
We can go mobile. I was going to do a reel on this, but.
Still do the reel on it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. This was my training partner, Hadley's in here. So this was all unfinished and we finished this basement. So pull-ups, dips, Australian rows, nice. Push-ups, calisthenics type work. And then I have a smart trainer set up in front of a laptop with a screen. Mm-hmm. And the trainer actually adjusts the resistance to be able to adjust how hard you're pedaling based off your power profile for the workout that you're doing. And then a treadmill. And it's all set up with my triathlon bike. So, and then a rowing machine. I'll row either active recovery or as part of workout for 10,000 yards each week, most weeks. And so, yeah. Home training.
You got everything you need in there.
In the basement.
You got a nice cardio setup. That's excellent.
Yeah, but even in medical school, all through I did my first Ironman at the end of the second year of medical school, and I trained for it on the trainer that I went in halvesies with my pre-med friend for like $70, with my laptop on an ironing board, and just ran 5 miles in the morning before med school classes, did a 60 or 90 minute bike ride on that little bike trainer. So this is a really nice setup now, but I spent 10 years on like a budget bike trainer with an ironing board, you know? So like you can, for those that have different setups, you can still do that. And this is like that, even just having a protected room is like the realization of a 20-year dream. But it was always a lot more modest before that.
I love it. I love it. I'm in the middle of, I mean, I still got to unpack everything, but I just moved out to my dad's house on Friday. I'm working on, over the next however long it takes, years, I'm going to buy my dad's house and hopefully I continue to work in the office that I signed the contract with. But making that home gym is just, it's so important. And you understand that you need, you need like everything. Because one thing I noticed, and you know this with residency, is it's great when you can like low maintenance, you could just go right into your other workout room. Or for example, in my apartment building during residency, I would just go into the basement. And now they only have had dumbbells up to 50, but I figured out a workout to get everything in that I could do in a, you know, a week's time or whatever. And that's, you need something that has everything you need, like the baseline need to kind of get through. Yeah. And oh my God, it's such a great switch in that mental space to just go into that room. And it's kind of like, all right, all the work is left at the door. Now it's time to sweat. It's time to huff and puff, you know?
Yeah. We need two shirts to come out of this. We need one for Black Clouds and then one for, are there any dumbbells heavier than 50? Is that the heaviest? Like you're holding out to 50-pound dumbbells? Or do you have 50 kilo? Because that would be fine. But 50 pounds is too light.
I was doing reps like 20, 16, 12 reps. Oh my, like that's a lot of reps. 20 reps, doing that twice. And it's a lot of reps. But you know what? It worked. You get more toned muscle, more dense, compact muscle. And over time, you could actually grow too, if you do it long enough. But hey, Dr. Weyrich, thanks so much for coming on today. I know we had to adjust the times like 5 times, but we finally made it work. And this will be part two. We'll obviously have part three in the future, you know, around our schedules again. But it was great to catch up, and thank you for taking the time too. Were you off today, or you already went to clinic?
Yeah. Today was my admin day. So I mean, the fact that I could benefit from being able to capture some of your time, I am so grateful for.
Oh, of course.
I'm just, with these little wormholes into this shared experience of social media, I'm really interested. It's really rewarding to think about where I was when I had the privilege of you gracing me with the chance to talk with you.
Stop it.
Last time, I'm really excited to see what it looks like next time. But if people get better education out of it, like that's what it's all about.
That's right. And they are. And you know, we're cut from a similar cloth, especially mentally. We're pushing for a better direction of all of healthcare. And you know, it starts with talking about it. So, and I appreciate the brainstorm too, thinking of ideas, how we can do this. So I guess I have to become president. You'll be the vice president and we'll go from there.
Works for me. Just you tell me where to sign. And then I'm there.
All right, my friend. We'll catch up soon. And hey, good luck next week on the run. You feel like you're ready to go?
Yeah. If my channel goes dark, it means I didn't make it. if it's a hot day. But if I don't make it, everyone, check your lipoprotein(a). Make sure you get that checked, or at least an ApoB.
That's right.
Yeah, no, it should go well. And then it's just, that's what it's all about, right? The process. Not necessarily how well we do, but did we do a good job for what we're capable of? How can we do better next time? So yeah, really excited.
That's right. That's right. All right. So good luck next week. We'll touch base soon and keep putting out that content. You got to get the one on the different, what do you say, underrated or under something?
Yeah, like underrated healthcare professional.
Underrated healthcare professional. I want to see that one come out. Make sure you do that one. I don't know whenever you get to it though, I want to see that one especially. That's great.
Love it. The flip side would be like, you know, like oral surgeons and neurosurgeons and plastic surgeons, as some of like the elite professionals. We know those guys are awesome. We got it. Hey, who are the people like, gosh, respiratory therapists, physical therapists, heart ultrasound technicians. Like there are some people that really, I don't think get as much validation as they should. So trying to rep them
you
a
know,
little bit.
Too. That just gave me a great idea. And I don't mean to keep you. What if we put together, we collaborated with other, I don't know, you know, people that are comfortable with making content, not necessarily like big names or famous brands, just people that are comfortable with making content. What if we all shared one of our toughest experience or stories in residency? And then we went from like one clip to one clip to one clip and put in a collage and then sent that on to post.
I love that.
That would be, because you explained one of yours, maybe there's another one. I could think of something. This could be, you know, an interesting post. If we all collaborated one, get four or five of us together. We should think of that.
Let's do it. Yeah. Collaboration.
Let's do that.
I think that'd be a lot of fun.
All right. You know, I'll put in a DM and then we add people in that. We'll see who would be interested in doing this. I think this would be beneficial for viewers. You know?
Awesome. Yeah. No, and that's the cool part is that I've had a number of people that have really advanced channels where they have messaged me and followed me and like invited me to discuss like different ways to collaborate with them. Like it's really, really impressive. And it's really, I think it shows the kind of mentorship and apprenticeship, collaborative kind of like fraternity, not male or female, but like the kind of fraternity, like the approach that we have as clinicians to support each other. So it's been really cool. I feel like a med student that has awesome attendings in the content creation space. So it's been a lot of fun to benefit from individuals like yourself. People have really been really, really kind in sending messages.
We're learning together.
Talking about collaborating.
Yeah. Yeah, man. And thank you. Thank you for that too. I mean, I got to give you thanks as well. I mean, you're teaching me every day too. I love the content you're producing and we get to sit down and have a nice long form content chat. But yeah, man. Hey, we'll touch base soon. Good luck next week. And I'll be posting this. Hopefully, I got to see when I get it up. It'll be by next week. Yeah.
Cool. Awesome. I'll be on the lookout and happy to steal some clips. And if I could receive a reel about an experience, I'd be happy to model that and then pass it right
along. Let's do it. All right. I'll go work on that right now.
Awesome.
All right, man. You have a good one. Have a good day.
Thanks, my friend.
All
you
right.
too.
Bye.